Hey there, welcome to Money Never Sleeps, a podcast that looks inside the head of entrepreneurs and at the crossover of startups, enterprise, finance, technology, and life as we know it. I'm Pete Townsend, your co-host on Money Never Sleeps, along with Owen Fitzgerald. This episode of Money Never Sleeps is sponsored by PAT Fintech, the training partner that demystifies fintech and digital finance for financial services professionals. In this week's Money Talk segment, we take a look at Druckenmiller versus Dalio on Bitcoin, how angels invest in startups, Tinkoff Bank and the return of the Rundle, and Airbnb versus Ant Financial in the battle of the IPOs, all packaged up as this week's episode of Money Never Sleeps.
Money never sleeps, pal.
Here we go again. Buenos noches, hermano.
How you doing, buddy?
I'm good. I'm tired. Was all fired up earlier today. I've been working with this crypto startup, and they're just blowing my mind. They're doing so much to make crypto far more accessible to people and make it very useful. And I'm working through, you know, pitch mechanics with them, and they're getting it. And it's just awesome to see them coming along so well. And then, had a little mishap with the side gate and was outside with my broken foot. Just so the listeners know, I had my foot surgically broken 3 weeks ago to fix a longstanding marathon injury and a few other things as well. So it's been quite interesting getting up and running again. Not running at all, but imagine going outside in gale force winds with one foot, with a screwdriver in one hand, and your wife holding on to her phone with a flashlight in the other while you try to screw a screw back into a stripped hole to keep the gate from banging all night. So yeah, that was my half hour evening before we started recording this fine evening at 9:22 p.m., right?
Yeah. We got some great feedback on the newsletter. I just said I'd throw that in there, which is great. Took me a bit longer to get it out this week than usual, but a lot of positive feedback on it around flywheels. I don't think it's a concept people are too familiar with, and I wasn't until I started looking into it a lot lately. Really interesting concept, though, and a lot of positive feedback, emails and stuff on it. So,
absolutely. When I read that, I just absolutely loved it. The flywheel, just so everyone knows, is basically Disney's, I don't know, business map, you could call it, of how it's all connected. Yeah. From theme parks to the movies to the merch,
the merchandise, the licenses, all of that, and how it's all connected. And what do they call it? Compounding advantages. It's a really interesting concept. So actually, I sent it on to a client that I thought might be of use in terms of their strategic piece they were doing. And I know you'd be in a position, for any listeners out there, to give them some guidance on that if there's anyone of any interest. But yeah, no, an interesting concept, because not one I was very familiar with. Kind of randomly came across it and, you know, went down that rabbit hole.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was great. And it's one of those kinds of things where you need the whiteboard, right? And I'm missing the whiteboard. And with the crypto startup I'm working with and talking about pitch mechanics, and I'm going through the hooks of each part of the pitch back to the last one and then setting the scene for the next one, or perhaps the one two or three pages ahead, right? Rather than putting it all together on a whiteboard. But we'll get there.
No, I know. So what have we got this week to talk about?
So what we have, starting with, it's the price of crypto, right? It's the price of Bitcoin that's gone up through the roof. And it feels different this time. It feels a lot different than 2017. We saw it run up above $16,000 and now up above $17,000 the last couple of days. It has institutional voices all opining on things. And two of these voices that spoke, I'm calling them Druckenmiller versus Dalio on Bitcoin. Right. And this was pointed out by Noelle Atchison in CoinDesk on the 15th of November. And she titled it "What We're Getting Wrong About Druckenmiller and Bitcoin." And then later on in the piece, which is her newsletter, her weekly newsletter, she talked about Dalio's view as well. And I'll talk about it, about Dalio in a second. But first on Druckenmiller, he's a former hedge fund manager. He ran money for George Soros in the 1990s, then his own Duquesne Capital Fund that he closed in 2010 to outside capital. And he's now just a family office with a run-of-the-mill $3.4 billion in assets under management. And he's personally worth over $4 billion. Never trust a billionaire, right? But yeah, in jest. Anyway, what did Stan say? Stan said that the Bitcoin bet will work better than the gold bet, which is interesting. Gold is always an investment that folks make, or not folks, institutions make as an inflation hedge. And talking about the standard gold inflation hedge bet in relation to the Bitcoin bet. And why he said it will work better is that there's more upside, is how Noel summarized it artfully, there's more upside due to the market inefficiencies in Bitcoin, right? Because of the differences in trading Bitcoin and how you need to get your head around that and how that all works compared to just trading traditional assets in traditional financial markets, right? There's more to do and there's more to get your head around it. There's more to play with. The reason why he said the market inefficiencies are there, what they specifically were, and again, Noel interpreting this, is that it's a thinner market, right? Which means that bigger trades move the market more. It's more illiquid, which means that bid-ask spreads are wider, which means there aren't always as many buyers as there are sellers, as there are in heavily liquid markets or heavily traded markets. And it has a lot more beta, which Noel interpreted as saying that he meant volatility, right? There is definitely a heck of a lot more volatility on Bitcoin than there is on gold. So those three things that he said, that it's a thinner market, it's more illiquid, it has more beta, those sounded like, okay, those are well-informed views.
And they're all accurate. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So then Ray Dalio came out. He's the founder of Bridgewater Associates and another billionaire, right? Author of the book Principles, which I'm in the middle of. Have you read that yet?
I haven't actually. I have it on my list of books to get. So.
Okay. I'm about 40% of the way through it, or as Kindle tells me, I'm 40% of the way through it. And the first 25% was his backstory. Great. Got that. Built an incredible business. And I love the way that he did that. Won't get into it. I'll let you guys read the book. And I'm now in the part where he's talking about his life principles. But the big thing I'm getting out of this, and this came out in the crypto Twitter over the last few days, is the truth, right? He's all about getting to the truth. It's not about, hey, I've got this opinion, you've got that opinion, let's argue about who's right. Let's find out what the truth is and what we do about it. And that's one of my key takeaways from the book. But I'm flipping through it rapid fire because a lot of it feels like common sense, but hoping I'm going to get some more sages. Wisdom, right?
Wisdom
is what I'm looking for. Okay. Anyway, so what he said is that you can't buy anything with Bitcoin easily. It's too volatile and it might be outlawed. I love you, Ray, but I can't wait to see the time machine that brought you back to the year 2012 when you came up with these things. Okay. Now, he didn't really set off a firestorm of a bunch of people jumping all over him on crypto Twitter. Now, I didn't read too much into all the replies and everything. You might have got some volatility thrown back at him. But what he's basically pointing out are things that people have already got their head around and already produced tons of material on. And one of the responses on crypto Twitter was Fidelity Digital Assets. Fidelity Investments have built their own digital asset custody solution and execution solution for Bitcoin primarily. They said, listen, Mr. Dalio, and they referred to him that way, which showed the tons of respect that folks have towards him, basically put in front of them their pushback on the pushback piece. So they did this piece and it landed in my inbox last week on here are the six things that people commonly are misinformed about when it comes to Bitcoin or crypto in general. And here's how to dispel those that misinformation. And Fidelity Digital Assets basically said, here, dude, go read this. I think he will, right? You know, he's been humble about it. He said, listen, if I'm wrong about this, I'd love to be, you know, corrected and sent in the right direction. I think Fidelity definitely sent him in the right direction. Anyway, big question. I know that from your perspective, you've never really been that big into this space, but is this interesting to you at all?
Yeah. Oh, you know, it is. And look, I mean, I work with blockchain companies. I have been responsible for a policy around cryptocurrency. So I have a certain level of understanding. I think I bought €20 worth of Bitcoin there a few months back. I sold it out at 27. So I did pretty well.
Buy yourself an ice cream.
Yeah. Yeah. No, do you know what? It's a funny one because I have been following it. And we'll put a link to the episode in the show notes. It was a fantastic interview with Anthony Pompliano and Dave Portnoy from Barstool Sports. And Pomp is big on Bitcoin. And he was trying to explain it to Portnoy. And I think it's a really useful example of just the general kind of view of the world that, you know, investors, either experienced investors or people who, you know, dabble in it, but would like to, like Portnoy's view was that, you know, he just didn't understand it. He, you know, if he lost his shirt on it, he wanted to have someone to blame. And there isn't that someone when it comes to Bitcoin. But, the reality is, and Pomp's argument was, you know, if you take 1% of your assets and put it in Bitcoin, like, you know, the bit I understand is that as an asset, as part of your portfolio strategy, why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
It's just an asset class. Like, in some ways, don't overthink it. You know, I'll probably go back into it. I should have kept my €20 in it. But
yeah,
if I had the money, I would assign a portion of it just as an asset class. It may go up or down. The bit I'd want to understand is the, and I know you know the name of that, like the companies that are piling into it.
Yes. You know, MicroStrategy, PayPal, yeah, no. You know.
And now even PayPal, like the reality is PayPal are just kind of processing it.
Square.
Yeah. And like, it seems like, oh, revolutionary when you have like PayPal and stuff, but like the reality is they're just getting in on something and they're charging fairly extortionate fees on the transferring of it or the cashing in and out. Like, it's not, I didn't think that was groundbreaking. Square putting a chunk of money into it is different than PayPal just allowing you to cash in and out using PayPal.
Yeah.
I didn't think that was really groundbreaking at all. It made a lot of noise, but like the reality is it's a thing that's here. It's been here. It's staying. It's an asset class. It's volatile. Maybe it doesn't make sense if you look at it from your normal kind of view of the world and your, I suppose, terminology or criteria you'd use when analyzing some other asset class, but you know, just keep it as a portion of your portfolio.
Yeah.
Don't overcomplicate it. Because I don't think you can. I don't think you can understand it enough, or there isn't the answers there. You know, Jamie Dimon, I think it was today, Jamie Dimon came out and he talked about it not being his cup of tea, but that the bank, JP Morgan, they're going heavily into that space, you know, because they see the potential. But Bitcoin itself is just not his cup of tea, as he phrased it. And I think there is that, what I call it, older generation. I don't know if that's the best way to describe it, but more, I suppose, not even older, more experienced, but used to things being a certain way.
Yeah, I know. And it's, the world is changing so fast. And this run-up feels a lot different than it did in 2017. In 2017, when it got pushed up, a lot of that with the ICO craze that was going on and where folks were buying Bitcoin and also buying Ethereum to fund basically the ICOs, or they were using Bitcoin to buy into the ICOs. And so you needed to get Bitcoin in order to get into the ICOs. And 80% of the ICOs turned out to be frauds or failed.
That's it,
right?
I think we've long moved past the idea of being outlawed. Even the fact that he would phrase it that way, I'm like, yeah, you're right. That's a 2012 view of it. It's not that anymore. Like central bank digital currencies and all these things. So it's not going to be illegal. It's not ever going to be illegal. It might be used for in illegal ways, but Jesus, banks. there's plenty of banks out there that have been fined heavily this year for money laundering. So it's not exactly like they're squeaky clean either. I think, you know, it definitely feels different. But I still think at the end of the day, you can't really understand it. The reality is it's a type of asset which is in short supply and the market will drive the price of it up. Like, Jesus, and this may be a stupid question, but like, what the hell would I buy gold for?
It's an inflation hedge. That's it.
Yeah.
Or if you have a certain view, a well-informed view based upon some global microeconomic trends, some global macroeconomic trends, where you identified, you think that gold's going to do X percent over the next 2 to 3 years, that's where you're going to make an investment in gold, right? And part of that decision is informed by your view on inflation, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if Bitcoin's in that realm yet. I think the Bitcoin or crypto economy, I think, is going to be operating. It already does operate on a whole different set of economic principles. And just thinking about that buying decision, right? And there are retailers that do accept Bitcoin. Right? And PayPal, right? You can pay through PayPal with Bitcoin. And if I had a major store of Bitcoin wealth and where I was making a decision about paying in US dollars or paying in Bitcoin, just because, I don't know, it was before payday and I wanted to buy something and I just happened to be sitting on a pile of Bitcoin, I may make a decision to pay with that, right?
Yeah.
And I can do that today and it's that easy. But that decision process about what to use to pay with something, these weren't really decisions that consumers went through, you know, 10, 15 years ago, right?
Yeah.
That is becoming more of a thing. And I think that is going to change. And I've said this before, the textbooks that our kids are reading, you know, in 10 years time, maybe not 10 years time, maybe, you know, 15, 20 years time, in terms of how the economy works, right? I think this is changing things. It's slow. And there's a lot of different storylines that will continue to unfold around this. But it's, I think you nailed it by saying it is a finite asset. There's a finite supply of it. And, you know, people are talking about ridiculous numbers of 320,000. You know, I've friends talking about, well, 20K might be the new floor. And to everyone out there, do not take this as investment advice. Only invest what you can afford to lose. Okay.
Exactly. And no, do you know what? I think actually a big part of what's different to 8 years ago is that the whole concept and the ease at which you can now trade even fractions of shares. Like, the reality is I can go into my Revolut and put it into fractions of shares or put it into a fraction of Bitcoin. It's no difference ultimately. And I have, if I have disposable cash, and I think that's the big difference. It's made it more accessible, but it's made it more accessible and more comparable to just something else. Because I go into my investing part of Revolut, and I can invest in gold as well. So it's just become another asset class there, in the same way. And I think, and like you said, the fact that, oh yeah, if I've that money sitting and I've made some sort of gain in Revolut, I can cash that out mid month or whatever, and be like, oh, I need to pay for something. Oh, I have that bit of money available, whereas, you know, the typical investment kind of portfolio, and you have it in stocks and shares through your bank or through your stockbroker or whatever, it's not liquid. So whilst Bitcoin is not liquid in the same way, it's still accessible through mm-hmm. the likes of a Revolut or something like that. So it makes it easier for people, I think, to dip in and out of it, which makes it more, obviously it helps on the price side, but it just makes it more comparable to a normal type of asset then.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did have a recent experience where professionally, I was paid in crypto for something, and I went through the whole process with that and was just, even though I've traded Bitcoin and ETH before, it was actual that commercial process of going through this and making sure it landed in the right business accounts and all those types of things after the fact. That was just a joy and a delight to go through and just see how quickly it all moves and how safe it felt, right, was the big thing for me. Which was really cool.
And the funny thing is, you wouldn't have taken the same payment in shares in Apple or whatever.
Absolutely not.
But yes, it's the same thing.
I know.
You know,
I just feel like it. I feel like it's becoming a currency, and it's something of value. And I have a view on the floor of a couple of the different cryptocurrencies, and I feel comfortable accepting payment in that for business services. So, you know. But it was eye-opening to go through that process, and I didn't expect. Key point with all this, I think, either way, the opinions expressed by everyone out there, especially by more and more big names in finance, whether they're well-informed or not, it's okay. It's not their fault if it's not well-informed, and they will figure it out. It's just another notch in Bitcoin's belt, holding up their big, huge, growing trousers of societal acceptance. Right, is kind of my capper on that.
On that note,
speaking of investing,
okay, so my favorite
Sifted, I'm just always loving what they publish and what they produce, what they curate, what they find and point out to me that I missed. Right, so shout out to them for this. They included in their newsletter in the last couple of days, or their email in the last couple of days, reference to an article that Gwen Sally had done. And she is the head of investment and services at Station F, the Paris-based startup incubator / accelerator. I think it's probably more of an incubator. But the article was How to Raise Funds with a Super Angel, and an interview with Fabrice Grinda. And he runs FJ Labs. He was a serial entrepreneur. He basically came up with the European version of eBay back in 2000, did quite well out of that, and is now not a billionaire, but a 100 millionaire. So I think you could trust him, right? So he gave a look in this article right down into the depths of how FJ Labs make investment decisions, them and their team. He is an angel or super angel, as they call them. Generally, super angels invest at the pre-seed or seed stage, sometimes follow on to the later stages if they have the capital to do that. But when you're investing in that level, generally, you might have a prototype of a product, but there's no recurring revenue and there's no customers. So there's a lot of risk. Right. And you definitely don't have your head around. You may have some nice financial projections, but, you know, generally at that level, they're going to be pretty finger in the air. So it was all wonderful reading through this piece that that Gwen wrote with Fabrice. And basically it was an interview, and where he said, you know, the basic things that he looks for when he's making an investment at an early stage startup is, one, do we like the team? Nice. Yep. Two, do we like the business? Of course. Three, do we like the deal terms? Generally, that's prescribed by the angel at that point. So they're probably going to like it. If not, they'll walk away. And four, does it meet our thesis of what the world currently is and where it is going, right? And that's, you know, that's understandable. Thought that all sounded great. And then I got down to a latter part of it. There is a detailed list of unit economics that they want to get their head around before they make an investment. All the wonderful things, all the wonderful acronyms, CAC, and a shout out to Shane Brett, who expressed his view on CAC at the Admitivate conference a couple of years ago, basically said he didn't know what CAC was. And when someone said to him, well, it's the cost of client acquisition, he's like, well, I'll tell you what the cost of no client acquisition is. That's bankruptcy, right? LTV, all the wonderful good stuff and different versions of that with different suffixes and prefixes on CAC and LTV. LTV is loan to value, not loan to value, lifetime value.
Lifetime value to customer, yeah.
LTV when you're dealing with fund to hedge fund lending, as I did years ago, way before Madoff. Anyway, all that good stuff. And I was thinking, I wanted to ask you about this, right? Because you're bringing a lot through seed stage, pre-seed. I generally, in what I do, I'm not seeing this level of depth or grasp in unit economics, either by the founders or by the investors at this stage. Are you seeing numbers asked for at that detailed level before a seed stage investor is making an investment?
I'll be honest. I don't think I've ever seen that presented in a deck or discussed in any level of detail. Like it's far too early. What am I looking at? Obviously, I'm looking at obviously the basics, but you know, we pay a lot of attention to the kind of cash flow model and the projections, but really it's trying to understand the assumptions because look, the numbers are finger in the air. You know, I'm working with a client at the moment. They had projected 7K revenue last month. They booked 44K, you know, changes everything. But, you know, it's the underlying assumptions. And we're looking at the kind of, if it's a SaaS business and the, you know, their revenue model and their license model and, you know, the stickiness of that customer ultimately and how ingrained they're getting into the, you know, with that customer and how difficult it'll be to unwind it. You know, because that look, those things will lead towards being able to understand the lifetime value. But I don't recall having ever seen it. And that's, and like, I look at obviously plenty of Irish stuff, but I see plenty of stuff from different markets as well, just for reference. I don't recall ever seeing it.
Okay. And I mean, it's something just twigged for me because in speaking with a startup recently that I'm working with, and the topic of TAM, SAM, SOM came up, right? Total addressable market, serviceable obtainable market, which is basically your market sizing, right? And what I said to them was, listen, finger in the air. Who cares what the number is? Just get the framework down. How are you actually going to size your market? And then you can go do all the research to find out what those numbers actually are, right? With the unit economics.
That's an important one.
You know, yeah, you'd absolutely need that. You know, that's a no-brainer. A whole bunch of
that. That's actually, that's one where you don't see necessarily the framework and you don't see enough kind of criteria around it. It's, oh, the market is this and we're targeting 5%. And on the basis of that, this is what we'll turn up, you know.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, no, I need more than that, guys. So that's sort of something, yeah, is something we look at and we'll always kind of go into detail on.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the market sizing, I was speaking to folks as well, and it was, okay, the wealth management market is 200 trillion. Let's start with that, right? And then we'll work down from there. But you have to, for your market sizing, you have to kind of figure out your own framework, right? Are you going to look at this by number of users? Are you going to look at this at flow in terms of, you know, the actual dollar value or euro value or pound value of the market that you're attacking? When it comes to unit economics, you already have a framework that's widely accepted out there in the market on what the unit economics should be, right? And what lifetime value should be. You kind of just have to get your head around it a little bit more and apply it to your business. So I think you can come up with the numbers. And I think I would be impressed to see this. And I think I'm going to have a look at the FJ Labs deal memo and see if I can translate that into something that's useful without it being overbearing and overkill. Because I think helping a startup put those types of numbers in front of an investor will be demonstrated at the very least. We've really thought through our market. We've really thought through how what we're going to sell and how much we're going to sell and our ability to scale that, right? Because when you get into year 2, 3, 4, 5, you really need to be talking about how you're going to scale it.
But that's what I mean. It's the assumptions. I don't really care. And it's the same with the addressable market piece. I want to know that you've considered it and this is your framework for considering X, Y, and Z. And at least then I can pick that apart. And whether it's based on what's out in the market and what other competitors are doing or whatever, at least it shows that you've thought about it. So my focus is always on the assumptions around the growth and the delivery to customers and all that, conscious that, you know, the numbers are irrelevant to a degree. So yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't see it referred to as CAC or LTV or anything like that, but it is the assumptions around obviously making sales and growing the business.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, good. I think we agreed on that, but I think there's a path forward to look at this a little bit deeper.
And just to finish on that one, I mean, there's a hell of a lot of good content out there around these particular topics. I'll see if I can find some. We can put some in the show notes, but it's one area you see a lot, especially on the SaaS side, around, you know, modeling this sort of thing and the assumptions of that. There's a lot of really good content out there from VCs and operators and stuff. So, you know, there's no shortage of focus on it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've got my list, you know, it's now growing in my bookmark bar to about the entire length of the screen in terms of all these little helpful resources. And went through with the guys I was working with today. CB Insights have this great view into pitch decks that have been used to raise money over the years. We went through five or six of them and pointed out the high points and the low points. And I think that was effective just to see, listen, we just talked through the pitch mechanics. Now let's go see some of this in action. So, you know, yes, I am a pocket accelerator, as a shout out to Ross Leonard said to me a couple of years ago, which was pretty fun. Anyway. This episode of Money Never Sleeps is sponsored by PAT Fintech, demystifying fintech and digital finance for financial services professionals. PAT Fintech enable financial services professionals to transform their capabilities into the digital age with dedicated virtual training programs geared towards those that can develop, deliver, and monitor optimally customized user experiences balanced by appropriate governance, control, and oversight. To learn more about PAT Fintech, go to moneyneversleeps.ie/PAT Fintech. Moving on. Yep. The next one you pointed out, Tinkoff launches Tinkoff Pro. This was actually pointed out by Simon Taylor from 11FS. Shout out to Simon on Twitter on Monday, the 15th of November. Also reported by Tinkoff News. I couldn't get into the Tinkoff News website. It was just rolling over on it. Tell us about this story.
Yeah, and like I said, it wasn't even that I saw it as a news story, but it was that Simon had promoted. But it comes back to the Rundles idea, the recurring revenue bundles that we talked about.
Yes.
And like to me, Tinkoff is probably the one out there that's closest to the likes of a WeChat. You know, and it's them going after the subscription model. So really what it is Tinkoff Pro is an all-in-one financial subscription to its ecosystem and partner services. So it allows you to use all of the products and services on one particular fee. So, for example, you get Tinkoff Mobile, insurance, bank, travel, business, lifestyle services, investments. So, you know, you pay one set fee on your card, whatever card pro or whatever kind of program you're set up with and whatever monthly payment you're making, it gives you automatically increases your interest on your savings accounts, higher cashback on travel, entertainment, transfer limits, all this sort of good stuff. And then, as well as that, it's a subscription into their partners. So things like premium subscription to the largest kind of video providers, they're the equivalent to Netflix and others out there. This to me is where the likes of a Revolut and others haven't moved. And I'm really surprised that they haven't yet, because I'm on Revolut, obviously. I got an email a few weeks ago about, oh, Revolut subscriptions. And I got all excited thinking, oh, finally, they're moving into this space. And it was just a, oh, we can manage your subscriptions that you already have. Like, you know, if I have something that comes out of my account every month, I think it's Spotify or whatever on Revolut, it's now under subscriptions. If I click into that little drop down or whatever, I'm like, wow, like that's it.
Yeah, thanks very much, Nick.
Yeah. So, like the reason, like I said, the reason I thought it was because we'd kind of gone into detail on the Rundles idea. God, it was probably a month ago, if not more at this stage. But this is the first one that's really out there, really pushing it ahead. Like I would see it that this is what will separate the Starlings, Monzos, and Revolut to the world, who can bring in the additional services into their ecosystem for one flat fee. That's what people will want. That's how I think you'll end up getting that customer and making the customer stickier and doing more business with them.
Yeah, I had a look into the Twitter run through on this a little bit, and saw that replying to Simon on this was a guy, Paul Loberman, a fintech guess who sorry, customers and products, always. Love SME, love super apps, great. Indie hacker noob. Generally, I think just out there talking good things about fintech, which is good to see. But he said, reminds me of a conversation he had with Bradley Leamer, who's big into fintech in the US 6 years ago, and said what basically you just said. What has stopped banks from doing this already with Netflix and Amazon Prime? Mobile provider contracts, bundle value with free Spotify or Sky Sports streaming. Would you pay for your N26 or Revolut if they were packaging all this up for you?
I think people will, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think it's a no-brainer. And it goes back to a tweet from Paul Loberman from 2018.
And you see, the difference is that the banks aren't going to do it because they don't have the relationships. I mean, you need to have a certain relationship to be able to bring in iTunes and Netflix and the others. You know, you're not coming at that from a bank. That's not your partner. It's a non-financial product. The challenge here is that banks typically, you know, haven't been able to sell non-financial products. So they don't have the depth of relationships that a tech company would have, or coming at it from the other side of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all about distribution, you know, and if I were Netflix entering a new country and there was a relationship available with a challenger bank in that country that it already has, you know, 500,000, a million users, whatever, I'd love to partner with them.
Yeah.
You know
that the integration and everything would be a hell of a lot smoother than trying to work with an established player.
Absolutely.
So really interesting. And again, like the first real example in on this side of the world of that kind of Rundle that we talked about.
And I love the Rundle. It, like I said, the last time he came up with
shout out to Prof G.
Yeah. And shout out to Prof G. But it also reminds me of a word from high school that my friends and I used to think was quite funny. And I won't share what that is, but shout out to Kenny White. And he'll know exactly what I'm talking about, won't you, Kenny? Anyway, moving on from that.
Yeah.
There was a few stories that came up that were all somewhat related, that were quite interesting. So the first one is the Airbnb IPO, which is going ahead, right? Over the last couple of days, maybe the last week, all the different news outlets were capturing. Here's all the things you need to know about the Airbnb IPO. And I won't go through them right now. But it feels like the Airbnb IPO shouldn't happen with everything going on with the pandemic. How can you actually feel positive about a business that is geared towards people traveling? For the most part, is geared towards people traveling. It just doesn't feel right. The Ant IPO, the Ant Financial IPO in China, that didn't go because Jack Ma spoke too much from the hip about what
he said. Some mean things, I think.
He did. He spoke too much from the hip is a nice way to put it, right? Yeah, he did say some mean things that the Chinese government just kind of said, "All right, you want to say that about us? We're going to cancel your IPO," right?
Yep.
So that got pulled down. But the Ant Financial IPO should have happened. Absolutely should have happened.
Oh, yeah. They're killing us. Right? Yeah.
So this is a view into regulatory intervention, right? And, you know, should the regulator intervene in the Airbnb IPO because travel with the pandemic is curtailed? No, I don't think they should. I think they'd be overstepping their boundaries. I think Airbnb should have made the call to put it on hold for at least a year. But the regulators stepped in with Ant. Regulators also stepped in Brazil with WhatsApp. A couple of months ago, we covered this, didn't we?
Yeah, I was going to say, and in a surprising coincidence, obviously WhatsApp wanted to roll out payments in Brazil. It's one of their largest markets. The regulator stepped in and said, no, we have to hold off lots of things we need to look at. And in a remarkable coincidence, the regulator and was it all the banks? I can't remember who was part of this new payment solution that's rolled out
this week. It was the central bank in Brazil.
Yeah, rolled out their own payment solution.
Yeah. So there were whispers of that. Then I don't think we might have mentioned that it was pulled back, but the whispers around the central bank doing their own thing at the time. But yeah, absolutely. So they said, sorry, you're not going to do that. We need to go first. I don't know where we go with these regulatory overtones. We've seen, obviously, the political-themed struggles with TikTok. Is this something we're just going to have to come to expect?
Possibly. Like I remember when we looked at it, when we were talking about TikTok and others, we were talking about this kind of breakup of the global market, you know, and a focus on, you know, country-specific markets, for want of a better description. And it seems like this is maybe what's starting to play out a bit more, is that regulators are starting to get involved. Because, look, obviously, the central bank and Brazil could be seen to benefit from a locally sourced or a locally created solution versus a WhatsApp coming into the market. are we going to see more of that? I mean, the Ant Financial one was just is kind of funny in a bad way, in the sense that obviously he spoke his mind at a conference where the head of the central bank or whatever had only just spoken on stage prior to that. So probably pick your battles a bit more wisely. And you can kind of dismiss some of that and be like, oh, well, look, that's what goes on in China, maybe. But seeing more of it in other markets, you know, it's a kind of worrying trend in terms of, especially when you work with companies who are trying to scale internationally. You know, we are a small market. We're not the target market for our companies we work with. It does make them have to really seriously consider the different markets they're looking to go into and the regulatory regime there and the challenges around that.
I'm with you. It's I just feel like the world has changed immeasurably in the last couple of years. And maybe it's just I'm getting older. It's not that I'm pushing back and that I'm afraid of it. I'm embracing it and saying, let's go forward with whatever happens. But I think the textbooks are gone, right? There's just, I think there's no more rules to how business, how commerce, how international diplomacy, how national domestic policy, any of that. I think it's all off.
I think what it might end up being is more beneficial for Europe as a market and Ireland by association then, because we'll have one set of regulations for 27 countries. You know, we then become a more attractive market than, you know, if you're coming from Asia or coming from the US, well, where do you go? Well, you know that you can operate in the EU under pretty much the same guidelines everywhere to a degree, you know, and the UK, obviously with Brexit, they're stepping outside of that, but they always had been doing their own thing anyway, from the regulatory point of view.
Absolutely.
So it might end up being very beneficial in that respect, which would be a good thing. But yeah, I think you'll just see clusters or a breakup of kind of this whole global view of the world.
Yeah, I know. And I would agree with that European argument as well, especially to loop it back to the beginning in the crypto space. And there's a lot of progressive regulation, both in draft and also in chatter coming out of Europe. And I'm speaking with a few folks about that as well. So yeah, all good stuff. Good news. We hit 12 today in the pod charts for Ireland in the entrepreneurship category, which is our category, right? That we're tracked on. So that was big. I had a couple of good experiences in the last week just from things that came from the different episodes that we're publishing. But I think last week when we had Chris Bergeon from Spark Crowdfunding, that was really eye-opening for me. And I pushed that out from the Irish Tech News website today that it gets posted up to as well. And, you know, said that on LinkedIn that, listen, this is something that people really got to think about, because there is a big gap in Ireland. There is a big gap that needs to be filled. My pal Lambert Despot, shout out to him. He's on his way to Barcelona. He came back and said, listen, Pete, it's not just Ireland. It's all of Europe that has this problem. And there is a big gap to fill. And folks like Fabrice Grinda from FJ Labs, for all his best intentions, he can't fill that himself, you know, and there's not enough of those angels out there that are taking these kind of risks at the seed stage, you know, like our pal Jason Calacanis in the good old US of A. Also watched today, I should have watched this before, but Brian McMahon from Expert Dojo, who we had on a couple of episodes ago, I watched his TED Talk video that he had sent to us before.
Yeah. I had watched it previously the first time around.
I hadn't watched it, and I watched it today and I'm like, okay, that makes a lot more sense now that I'm hearing it from that perspective than when I was listening on the broken line when it snapped during our interview a few weeks ago. So, you know, going back and listening to that one more time as well. Cool. Any other key points from you before we shut this one down for tonight?
No. Like I said, great feedback on the newsletter so far. Keeping it moving along. I think we've got some good guests coming up over the next few weeks on the podcast as well. Plenty going on, coming up to the end of the year as well, getting very busy work-wise, but good busy, lots of good projects to be working on, clients to be helping out. So yeah, it's all good.
Absolutely. In my email inbox, I've got, I think, 6 or 7 very interesting people to talk to for episodes. Out of those 6 or 7, there are only one is not a white male. So that's a bit of a problem. we got to do a lot better in that area. So, you know, looking to do better there. Anyway, I think we'll call it at that for tonight, Owen. Thanks, pal.
Yep.
Adios.
Fun as always. Take it easy.
That wraps it up, folks. Thanks for listening to us try to figure out why the world does what it does. Links for the stories we covered are in the show notes for this episode on moneyneversleeps.ie, so check us out online. Also, you can subscribe to our Money Never Sleeps newsletter at moneyneversleeps.substack.com. If you're enjoying Money Never Sleeps and want to see it continue, make sure you hop on over to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. And don't forget Conan Brophy from Create Sound. He mixes and edits each episode for us and is an excellent media man to get in touch with when you're thinking about launching your own podcast. As for me, I help startups get their products to market, get customers, and finance their vision. You can find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, or at norioventures.com, and you could follow Owen on Twitter at OwenFitzgerald9. Finally, till next time, thanks for listening. See ya! Money never sleeps, pal.